Welcome to the Arab Spring, a history. Episode 14, A New Dawn. As Britain was no longer able to use war as an excuse to intervene, and was busy all over the world, the British mostly left the WAFT to their own devices. You'll recall from last time how Lampson had threatened to remove Farouk from office if he did not install Nahas and the WAFT into power. This was all very embarrassing for the WAFT, so they tried to distance themselves from their image of British lapdogs by focusing on their Egyptianness. Arabic was made the official language for correspondence and commercial accountancy, which annoyed the British and other foreign states to no end. Despite this attempt, the WAFT was a spent political force. Corruption and political scandal had taken out the body's popularity. Only the British were keeping them in power. When Lampson was absent from Egypt in October 1944, Nahas was deposed and replaced by Ahmed Maher, brother of the pro-Axis Prime Minister the British had forced out from the last episode. Ahmed Maher was a very different person to his brother, and pushed for Egypt to declare war on Germany to ensure it would be permitted to join the new organisation which would replace the old League of Nations, the United Nations. Ahmed Maher announced this to the Parliament on the 24th of February 1945, and as he left, he was assassinated, most likely by the terrorist ring of the Muslim Brotherhood, an organisation which was growing fast. Sadly for the region, there will be many more political assassinations before we finish this story. As World War II wound down across the globe, new decisions had to be made. Not only what to do with the defeated countries, but also to do with those who had backed the Allies. Egyptians expected to be rewarded by the British with full independence, and their hopes would no doubt have been raised by the election of Clement Attlee as British Prime Minister in 1945. Winston Churchill is probably the most famous British Prime Minister around the world, certainly more famous than Attlee, but Attlee is one of Britain's more well-known Prime Ministers. The main reason was that his Labour Party introduced the National Health Service. But the secondary reason was that Attlee began the task of decolonisation. Attlee's premiership saw the end of the British Raj, with India, Pakistan, Burma and Sri Lanka all receiving independence. In Egypt, they too hoped that independence would be a reward, as well as allowing Egypt to rule the Sudan. They would be disappointed. Maintaining Britain's position in the Middle East was one of Attlee's priorities, and he would not compromise this by changing the 1936 agreement. This was uniformly unpopular. The WAFT, Egyptian communists, and the Muslim Brotherhood all played a role in the violent riots which followed. At the urging of Sidki, who had been reappointed Prime Minister, the British were prepared to make a deal involving the Suez, as long as they could reoccupy should a future conflict break out. If you remember the crisis in Iran and Azerbaijan from the last episode, the Cold War was looming. If war was to come with the Soviets, Britain wanted to make sure that Egypt would be on their side. There would be several conditions to such an agreement. Britain would need to maintain troops in Palestine, Libya, Cyprus, and the Sudan. Should things turn against them in Egypt, control of the Nile was crucial. An agreement for British evacuation within 3 years was made, though the issue with the Sudan was glossed over, both sides believing that they would get what they wanted. It became clear very quickly that this wasn't the case. as the British began preparing Sudan for self-government. Britain did indeed move all its troops out of the Delta into the Canal Zone, though while the 1936 agreement spoke of 10,000 troops there, Britain had over 70,000. Meanwhile, significant political developments were going on to the north. I wanted to tell the story of Egypt and then go back and tell the other stories, but more important than the way I want to tell the story is a clear and fair understanding of the facts. Therefore, at least for the moment, I'm going to tell the story of Israel and Palestine along with Egypt. It is impossible to understand the motivations of Nasser without going into just what was happening in Palestine. We last left Palestine in the early 1940s. So, what was the thinking of both sides, the Jews and the Palestinian Arabs, as the British tried to bring about a peace and keep the region quiet? The Jews had rejected a British offer of a Jewish homeland in the Peel Commission, which included much of Palestine, but not all Jews agreed. Many wanted to accept the deal, which would finally give them a homeland, but more were outraged that the deal would not include Jerusalem. The deal was rejected, but they welcomed it to bring further negotiations. The Arabs, on the other hand, were bitterly disappointed at receiving a very small portion of Palestine, being effectively taken over by Abdullah in Transjordan, and no doubt the loss of Jerusalem hurt too. While the Jews were guaranteed not to cause much trouble for the British during the World War, they were just about the last people who wanted German domination. The Arabs were an issue, and so to keep them quiet, a deal was made which promised to limit Jewish immigration and to create a Palestinian state within 10 years. This 1939 white paper caused deep resentment from the Zionists. Israel's first Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion, said that they would fight the war as if there were no white paper, and fight the white paper as if there were no war. That was where we left things. So, what happened next? Tension was rising across the region. With the Western powers pulling out and ending the mandates, an agreement needed to be reached. The new Arab states were deeply suspicious of what was going to happen in Palestine, and of just what the Jews were planning, and the newly founded Arab League was determined to provide assistance to the Palestinian Arabs. The Jews began preparing for a world without the Western powers, with many serving in the paramilitary force, the Haganah. Linked in with this was an expansion of the Jewish arms industry. It could supply the British for now, but when they were gone, it would be vital infrastructure for the new Jewish state. As the World War progressed, the Zionists turned against Britain. Britain deported illegal immigrants who had escaped from Europe. This was combined with the dark news coming out of Germany. The brutalities of the Holocaust reached Palestine, and the Jews were furious. Just how had this happened? Why had no one stopped Hitler before it was too late? The British were blamed for failing to rescue the European Jewry, and the population turned against them. A senior British figure, Lord Moyne, was assassinated in November 1944 in Cairo. In short, Zionism was through with Britain. While the old figures still thought Britain the home of Zionism, new figures, such as David Ben-Gurion, moved the movement to the United States. In New York, Zionism affirmed its program of unrestricted immigration and the transformation of Palestine into a national Jewish homeland, which would be fully integrated into the new democratic world which was emerging. The Second World War ended, with both sides having assisted Britain during the war. Attempts by some Arabs, notably Haj Amin, to bring the Muslim world into the Axis fold had proved unsuccessful. Both sides had reason to be hopeful. While the Palestinians had the 1939 white paper, the Zionists were enthused by the election of Attlee's Labour government. Labour had opposed the white paper, and in 1944, had mentioned the idea of the Arabs just moving out of Palestine to make room for the Jews. While the Zionists had high hopes, it became clear immediately, upon reaching power, that the reality was a lot more complicated than that. Britain was still a superpower. It was one of the big three, a status it desperately wanted to cling on to. While Britain gave independence to India, this made holding on to the Middle East more important than ever, both to maintain its reputation and to prepare for a world which was entering the Cold War. Whatever the solution would be, it was clear that the 1939 White Paper would not be it. The White Paper would have created a binational state. Considering the material we've covered already, it should be clear why this was a terrible idea. But given World War II, it became impossible. World War II and Hitler made the Jewish question a much greater problem than it was beforehand. All the Jewish refugees needed a home, and Palestine seemed the perfect solution. No one in the West wanted them to go elsewhere. Much of the Zionist movement depending on sympathy to its wishes. 50 years previously, the movement was powerless, but with strong support and with global sympathy, now was an opportunity to create a Jewish homeland. If you want more information on this, there is a very good section at the beginning of Tony Judt's Post-War, A History of Europe Post-1945, which covers European guilt over the Jewish question. I'd recommend giving it a read. From this point, Britain would not solely decide Palestine's fate. The United States would share responsibility. President Truman demanded the immediate entry of 100,000 Jews, and Congress wanted unrestricted immigration. To try and come to a solution, an Anglo-American inquiry was created, which proposed in April 1946 that the mandate continue with a unitary state. Restriction on land sales were to be lifted, 100,000 Jews would be allowed to enter Palestine immediately, while the Jewish paramilitary forces, estimated 65,000 strong, were to be disarmed. This was considered impractical by the British government as its popularity plummeted. The Zionist Underground blew up the King David Hotel in Jerusalem in July 1946, which contained British civilian and military officers. The Arab League began to get serious too, holding meetings, planning to harm British and US interests if Arab rights in Palestine were violated. Britain was in an impossible situation. Its own population was divided between Zionist sympathisers and those outraged by the terror tactics being employed. It needed to maintain its Middle Eastern interests, which would fall apart if Zionists were allowed to take Palestine, while it was also broke and needed US financial support, and the US wanted massive Jewish immigration into Palestine. It made a desperate attempt to create a plan which both sides would agree to, but neither did. The problem was handed over to the United Nations in February 1947, and in September, they announced they would give up the mandate for Palestine next year. In August, a special commission recommended dividing Palestine into two states, which would be economically unified, while Jerusalem would be an international city. This proposal won favour with the Jews, who were happy to accept it. They would receive 56% of land, though this included the Negev. The Negev is a desert presently in southern Israel, and in recent years has been developed faster by Israel than other areas of settlement, which receive more attention, such as the West Bank. During her time in office, former US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said that the Negev was the future of Israel. This deal was opposed by the Arabs, as they were against the very idea of partition, wanting a single Arab-dominated state. They were aggrieved that the proposed Jewish state would contain as many Arabs as it would Jews. the United States backed it due to Zionist pressure, and the Soviet Union saw Zionism as a struggle against imperialism, causing it to back it. With support from these two great powers, it passed the United Nations General Assembly on the 29th of November 1946 to become General Assembly Resolution 181. It had secured the necessary two-thirds majority, though this required some last-minute pressure from the United States. There were 33 votes in favour, 10 abstentions, and 13 votes against. Those votes against coming from Islamic Asian countries. They were outraged that the United Nations, at the time essentially the United States and Europe, was deciding their fate. They proposed that the International Court of Justice question the competence of the General Assembly, considering that it passed a motion which was against the wishes of the majority of the population it was concerning. In 1946, the population of Palestine contained 1,269,000 Arabs and 678,000 Jews, but it was narrowly defeated. With the United Nations having agreed a plan, you would think that the process would now become simpler, but it was not to be. The United Nations had no way of implementing a partition, and had no idea how to do so. This could perhaps be solved with time, but as already mentioned, the British announced they would leave within a year of September 1947. Britain refused to implement a policy which did not have the agreement of both sides, and refused to be involved with the United Nations Palestine Commission, which was to organise the transition. The result? Britain basically allowed communities to organise themselves. Jewish communities were much better organised than their Arab neighbours. Almost immediately, communal fighting broke out, and the country was in civil war. America became incredibly nervous about forcing the partition, and so began to try and renegotiate a deal in the United Nations, but things were too far advanced. The Palestinians had initial success, but the Jews were soon winning the war, taking many key cities and most of Arab Jerusalem. It was an intense fight within Palestine, which lasted until the 14th of May 1948, when the British withdrew. The Jews declared the creation of the State of Israel, which received de facto recognition within hours from the two great superpowers, the US and the USSR. Most neighbouring Arab states wanted to defend the Palestinians, and they joined in for the second stage of the war, and they hugely outnumbered the Israelis. On paper, the whole Middle East was at war with 600,000 Jews, but this was not true in practice. The forces sent against Israel were much smaller than Israel's army, and the Israelis were much better organised with better equipment. Israel roundly won the war. How did this happen? The Arab states were more interested in their own issues, although the populations were furious about the Palestinian issue. Abdullah in Transjordan was more interested in bringing the Palestinians under his protection than actually fighting. And a week before Israel's declaration of independence, had signed a non-aggression treaty. Transjordan was essentially a British client state, and part of the reason for the war was to keep Abdullah out of Palestine, as much as it was fighting the Jews. The fighting finally ended in February 1949, by which time the Israelis had taken almost 80% of Palestine, an expansion of the 56% they received in the 1947 UN division. Gradually, in early 1949, the Arab states made peace with Israel. The end result was that Jerusalem was divided, temporary borders were set up, Egypt gained administration of the Gaza Strip, Transjordan gained administration of the West Bank, turning the kingdom from Transjordan into Jordan. Half of Palestinians, almost 700,000, became refugees, the other half being divided between Israel, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank. Most Arab states were extremely embarrassed. and it became clear that peace and security were a long way away. In the Arab world, the event is known as Al-Nakba, the disaster. This was a momentous event which would have repercussions across the Arab world, but its key effects for the moment were ruining the reputation of the British, Americans, and Arab leaders. In Egypt, a group of young army officers, known as the Free Officers, were coming to the conclusion that to save their country, they would need to take action. They were gathering around one man in particular, a man who we'd met before, Gamal Abdel Nasser. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please visit us online, thehistoryofpodcast.com, facebook.com/thehistoryofpodcast, twitter.com/thehistoryofpod, youtube.com/thehistoryofpodcast, and thehistoryofpodcast@gmail.com. I'll see you in 2 weeks when we return to Egypt to see the rise of Nasser. Allah.